You know your love can be more limited than me. Higher, higher, higher.
We're on.
I got us on the tweet. Don't say anything funny yet.
I don't think that's really a problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's some good music in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
As soon I was watching it, I went straight to Apple Music and added the soundtrack to my collection.
Oh.
Did you seriously just favorite your own tweet?
Yes. Well, I mean, nobody knows it was me.
could it be now? Because it's in the recording. We'll keep that in.
No.
For a little inside baseball.
Well, it's too inside. We're literally starting with that. No, we gotta give a greeting for all of the new listeners who we have brought on board. Unfortunately, with our I don't know, scheme, plan, something.
It's all coming to fruition now, isn't it?
Yes.
Are we in step two or step one of the underpants scheme?
What's the underpants scheme?
You know, the South Park collect underpants, step two, question mark, step three, profit.
Oh. Yeah. I know the meme.
you're going to make all the new people think that you don't know how to pronounce meme.
Well, I don't. But, hello, new people. I'm assuming there are some new people, but today, this very day, not the day that this is released, because who knows when you're listening to it, but on the 14th of October... 2015, that is the year, just double checking. We moved our humble little podcast over from our independent roots over to the mothership, the big nerdy airship in the sky, the incomparable, as one of their shows. We are not anticipating much of a change to anything we do. For people who are not familiar with what we do, that can be a bad thing, but keep an open mind, because we might surprise and delight you with, I don't know, we'll think of something later. We bring things to the table, stuff, a couple things.
We bring expertise in visual effects and filmmaking, and lots of dumbness and puns.
Yes, because for those unfamiliar, let's do like a little clip show thing, and we'll just do the wavy, like...
I'll do the thing with my hands like they did in Wayne's World.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that
works. I'm not going to do the sound, though, because that was weird.
Well, that's... okay, good. This is really good podcasting. Flashback here. Dan, move your hands. And so, Dan does...
Why did I actually move my hands? Nobody can see me.
Well, you don't have to tell them that.
Well, I actually did it.
Oh.
Anyway.
Well, you didn't have to say that either, because now they're not going to believe you, because now they're going to think that you don't do it anytime you don't say that you did something.
That was like a triple negative.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Positively. Our show, we basically dissect about a movie or a television unit a week, and we also sometimes talk about things like trailers or things related to media consumption, like a... certain streaming set-top boxes or something. That's just the sort of the way we roll here on this thing that rolls for some reason now that I just said that. And we have great respect for the craft of filmmaking, as well as mostly just making fun of it. Dan is...
We speak from a place of love and some knowledge, because this is what we do for a living, and we can make fun of ourselves as well as other people.
Yes, and Dan does more, like, on-set-ish things than I do, let's just say, because he actually has, like, a set that he'll go to on occasion and, like, shoot and film things, and will describe cameras and Bayer patterns and all that. So if you like that kind of stuff, he's there to cover that. And then as for me... it's mainly all of the bits and bobs that happen with the computer. You know, you just push the make digital character button, and then out it pops. And I'm just there for button maintenance. So that's
yes. Which visual effect will most appropriately make you mad at new Apple technology is your expertise?
Okay. Yeah. Well, it would be like the parallax icon thing. But so let's get into. That was really like a terrible intro for us, but I guess that's normal for us. That's par for the course.
I've always had trouble coming up with any sort of bio about things that I do myself. We kind of have to leave it in other people's hands to describe what we actually do, and I think we kind of summarized what some of the other people said about us in other places, but yeah, it just seems so, so self-centered to describe all of the nice things about ourselves.
Well, I mean, we have to tell them, hey, there's a reason you're listening to us.
Because we're on the internet.
Yeah.
Well, it's radio on the internet.
They can't possibly be that bored, Dan. So this we normally start off with a little bit of a sandwich here where we have some of the nonsense, some of the shenanigans, like how's your week, et cetera, so on and so forth. And then we go into the movie media item, and then we fade out into more nonsense until we don't know how to end the show. So when you get to the end of this, don't be surprised, because it'll just sort of like stumble over itself and fall out the door. That is how this typically ends.
Mm. Speaking of super meta nonsense, you would think by now I would have learned my lesson with the Apple TV, but that is not the case. Because I rented the movie again on the Apple device, and it actually gives you a warning now on the Apple TV when you rent. It says you can only watch this here, and I said, well, I don't want to do that. I want to rent it on my laptop so I could like finish it there if I had to. So I rented it on the laptop, but you can't AirPlay because the button doesn't show up. A, if you have an HDMI monitor plugged in, which I did, and then I unplugged it, and B, you can't AirPlay it until it is finished downloading, which luckily it downloaded very quickly because I got that fiber now. But you would think I would remember these things instead of just sit there clicking around randomly and then crossing my fingers that it would work. And there's also two AirPlay buttons. There's one in the play interface and one at the top of the iTunes interface, and only one of them actually works. Fun new information that I should have learned a long time ago.
Listeners, Dan has not learned how to purchase things on his computer or rent them so that they are available to watch after doing this show for over a year.
So. Well, the thing is, they only want you to watch it where you rent it, and I wanted to have the ability to watch it in more than one place, so I rented it on a laptop and I AirPlayed it to the TV, which is that's how I did it before, just because I had to, because I was dumb, but this time I did it on purpose. With a couple of caveats. So,
okay. That. Well, it's a really awesome life hack, Dan.
Yeah. Did you rent it or buy it?
I bought it because it's a classic.
It is. You know, it's one of those ones that's always on a TV, and being the sequel to a very famous, very well-loved movie, I always sort of misremember it as like not being a good movie, but it's actually a really good movie, and I really like it.
Well, I think it gets a bad rap because you compare it to the first one, and there are so many things in this that are, it's not like a one-to-one relationship with the first one, but there are so many things where it's kind of a little similar to the first one, like certain arcs in the story are a little similar, certain kinds of characters, like we have a bad guy from the government in the first one, and we have a bad guy from the government in the second one. We have a mayor who refuses to believe and then suddenly comes around. And then we have the same mayor who refuses to
literally
believe.
The same actor, same mayor, yes.
Yeah. So there are some things that carry through. There's also some absurd ridiculousness in this one that strains credulity, even in terms of the laws that they're setting down inside of the movie universe, you know, as far as like what ghosts are doing or what certain kinds of let's just say there's just like some flexibility that they leave themselves that I don't understand why it needed to be there. Like sometimes they'll just have like a thing inside just for no apparent reason, like that monster thing that goes through the arch. It's like, oh well, that's interesting.
It's production value.
What was it? And then
it's just a large terrorizing ghost thingy-mabob.
Yeah, exactly. Like what died and made that? Like as far as ghosts go, I mean,
what died and made Slimer?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. And again, we have a little bit of the sequelness here when we have a Slimer because, well. let's just say it's just like this character was really popular and he's in the cartoon and the cartoon is really popular. So we have to put him in the film and he's going to be kind of not really like working with them, but working enough with them, like positive enough that he'll have his own title card at the end of the credits.
I mean, he clearly lives with them. He eats Lewis's food and he drives a bus for some reason. So, I mean, he's keeping busy. He's doing some stuff.
Yeah. And that's, you know, all based on the success of the real Ghostbusters cartoon series.
Yeah.
And this is a sequel that happened with a significant amount of time in between. And
I love that the very first frame of the movie is a title card that just says 5 years later. It's like, well, thank you for clarifying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how would you have known? Because it could have been like 5 seconds later. She totally had a baby and got married and had a divorce. I think Dana Barrett's storyline is probably the most convoluted thing in the film. Because all the things that she did off camera in her own personal life and the things that she does now for like a job and stuff in this, it's so strange.
No.
It's like they kept like coming up with like things they wanted to do. Like, oh, well, we want to have a painting and we want to have it come to life with like a dead Carpathian ruler or something like that. And so they're just like, well, maybe somebody's doing like paint restoration. Okay, great. But how are we going to tie that in with our characters? I know it can be Dana. Well, doesn't she play like a cello and stuff? But she had a baby. She had a baby? Yeah, so that's why she's working with paints.
Which is apparently just, it's less time consuming than playing in the symphony. So that's why she's doing this job temporarily.
Yeah, what a crazy in-between job she found herself.
Restoring Renaissance period artwork. That's sure. I mean, it's some nice... It's a nice gig if you can get it, I suppose.
Yeah, she's working at Gauguin, you know. Just like, but she's got to go back to, you know, playing in the orchestra. And, like, the whole thing with fleshing out the specific background of the guy that she had married and left her and had the baby with, and that guy, like, how he was also in the orchestra and he left to go to London. And
there's not a lot of smooth exposition, but there is a lot of exposition in the beginning of this. I do like, did you plan this on purpose as being the follow-up to last week's movie? Because it was quite perfect, actually.
No, I didn't, and it made me laugh so hard because I totally forgot about the line. When we did the He-Man last week, and we were talking about how ridiculous that was, and it was a children's cartoon show, and it was all about like tapping into... you know, things that interest kids, and then here we have it, the opening with Ray and Winston, where they're at a kid's birthday party, although you don't know it from the outset. You think they're there to bust some ghosts, and he's like, how tall are they? She's like, about 4 feet, and so they go in there, and it's just like, oh, they're kids. And weirdly, in the Ghostbusters universe, they have the theme song from the previous movie as something you can play. Yeah.
That one that got sued over too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and also a funny thing about this is I think we talked about this last time. There was some lawsuit action going on with a cartoon called Ghostbusters that Filmation did, and so there was that. But Filmation also makes the He-Man cartoons, and so it's kind of funny that they chose He-Man for this line when they ask who you're gonna call, and all the kids shout He-Man, and I laughed a little.
Yeah, apparently He-Man is the hero that the kids really want. I don't know why you would want He-Man to show up at your kid's birthday party, because as I think we established pretty well last week, he's just oily and dirty and just probably smells really bad. But he's tall and large.
Yeah, but they probably want a cartoon He-Man.
Well, I mean, how do they expect a cartoon He-Man to actually come to a kid's birthday party? That's
because they're children, Dan. They don't really understand anything.
Well, in this world where heroes who have fallen on hard times actually go to the kids' birthday parties themselves, presumably Dolph Lundgren would have been the guy showing up to this kid's birthday party.
Yes.
I just hope he would have showered and like maybe not brought the sword, or at least brought like a replica sword that wasn't so heavy.
Okay. Well, they brought their proton packs.
Not a super smart idea, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I am just saying, you know, particle accelerators around small children is not super safe.
Yeah, well, so. they didn't really seem like especially nice kids. If we lost one or two, it'd be all right.
Sure. A little radiation poisoning never killed anyone.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, survival of the least radioactive is what I say. And besides, it was just getting into that trend in the 80s and 90s where all of your heroes were mutant radioactive things. So, you know, they could have got in early on that. Maybe they could be at some birthday parties if they had really planned this out.
Speaking of the 80s, this being 1989, you would think the 80s are sort of like trailing off and starting to migrate themselves into the styles of the 90s. But no, this is the most 80s movie I've ever seen.
Well,
between the music and just the general action and attitude and the clothing and all that stuff.
No, I'm going to disagree a little bit here. Like, you can tell the difference between this and the first Ghostbusters movie, because this one has the rap music / R&B stuff that they kind of make and they force lyrics into that have to do with the film. Too hot to handle, too cold to hold. They called the Ghostbusters and they're in control. Had a throwing
party for a bunch of children. Well, all the while, the slime was under the building. So bad. So bad.
So cringeworthingly bad. But they squeeze that stuff in, and that really sets it apart. Like, you know, think about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Think about Adam's Family. Like, remember the Adam's Family rap, Dan?
I absolutely do not. And I kind of want to forget that you just said that because it sounds horrible.
Well, maybe if you play your cards right, we might talk about it on the show.
I don't want to.
Yeah, well, you just keep playing those cards, and we'll see.
The most cringeworthy rap in this one is the one in the end credits, right? Like, that's the one where he's, like, really rapping the lyrics the movie? Combat evil's presence, make it pleasant in every resident, and take a mother's newborn baby, and Dana's the lady, to build an establishment for an evil magician on a mission in the picture position, and no condition will stop him on the transition of making it in time with the help of slime. But somebody got to draw the line. What's in for all? Who you gonna call for the ball? Ghostbusters! It's like that, y'all. Ghostbusters! It's like that, y'all. Ghostbusters! I'm back. Ghostbusters! I'm back. It's like that, y'all. Hit it, spirit. Some people hear it, some people fear it. That is
the one that is like, this is specifically for this film.
Is that is that one of the Bobby Brown ones?
No, that was somebody else. I can't remember. There is a Run DMC cover of the Ghostbusters theme that was originally done by Ray Parker Jr.
Which, by the way, is apparently so popular you can't stream it in Apple Music. You have to buy it album only in iTunes.
Yes.
Along with whatever Elton John song is on the album. I didn't realize there was an Elton John song on there.
I didn't either. Was there? When did that happen?
There's one in there. I'll tell you what it is if you want.
Sure. Go ahead.
It's called Love is a Cannibal.
Not ringing any bell from when I just watched it. There's an Oingo Boingo song with Danny mm-hmm. Elfman.
I'm a fan of Oingo Boingo, specifically their work in the film Back to School.
Well, what's
very nice cameo.
I haven't seen that. But what's interesting here is that they opened and had the biggest, I think, weekend or three-day weekend box office. And then the week after them, it was Batman opened, and they got the biggest one. And that was scored by Danny Elfman. So he was in two of the biggest opening movies within 2 weeks of each other. Isn't that interesting?
Well, good for Danny Elfman.
Yeah. All he had to do was just, like, make some music stuff.
that is his job.
Yeah. Well, let's get into this. Like, the actual, like, thing. As far as, like, setting up where everyone has gone in 5 years.
Right. So, aside from the fact that they are disgraced and they're at a kid's birthday party, they go out to the car to reload their proton packs and split their $200 or whatever they got for the party, and Winston gives us the gigantic exposition bomb about how they got blamed for all of the damage and didn't get paid for it, or, you know, they got stuck with the bill, as Venkman says, and they don't have any work, they're out of business, all that fun junk. So that's nice. Actually, we got the out of business exposition from one of the punk 14-year-olds at the party.
Yeah. Well, the other thing here is that we glossed over the Baby's Day Out opening sequence where...
Oh, of course. How could we?
Oh, yeah. I don't think this is a strong way to start a film. I thought that the library sequence was a better start from the first film. Because this one...
doesn't have any visible ghosts or anything? Just a little bit of slime on a wheel?
Yeah, there's a little bit of slime on a wheel and some really shady wires pulling a carriage down streets in New York.
There's some nice dolly camera tracking work in it.
Yeah, but it's a baby in a carriage, and it feels like it's being pulled around. Like it's just not great. And
I do like the close up shots of a little Oscar bouncing in there.
No, I especially despise those because this just every time they like put him in peril and they just show him smiling, it literally reminds me of Baby's Day Out. I know that movie came out after this, but still. It reminds me of that every time I see it. It's just sort of that, oh, look, it's sort of like a cartoon where this baby's crawling around and all this terrible stuff's happening around him.
So you especially love the part where Oscar was kind of like propped up standing on the ledge and clearly not on his own 2 feet?
Yeah. I wish they had done something else other than have this baby in here. Like, I know they must have really been behind this idea. Because it's through the whole film and just putting this baby in jeopardy, but in like cartoon jeopardy. And also it doesn't seem to make any sense. Like, the slime, seems to want to endanger the child, but stops the carriage from hitting into the side of the bus. But this is before Viggo is trying to steal him. So it's like, well, why would it care if he died, and why would it try to take him? So it doesn't make a ton of sense, but it does.
I thought it was just drawing him toward the river of slime. I'm not sure what its plan was to get it five stories below the road, but it did stop right above the river of slime. So presumably if his little carriage had just fallen straight down into the river of slime, the river would have taken it to the art gallery where Viggo could have, you know, like... hold on to him for a while. I don't know. I guess he was going to wait for it a little bit anyway.
Well, it does. But you see, Viggo didn't know about Oscar. Janosz tells him about Oscar later, much later. So at this part, it's just like just a random baby kidnapping. Were there other random baby kidnappings that were being left uninvestigated?
Yeah, maybe the slime is just trying to grab the closest baby it can grab because it needs a baby.
Yeah.
Just any baby that crosses the slime's path will immediately be pulled toward the river of slime.
Okay. Sounds like a sound policy. But then, like you're saying, we have the birthday party, which is funny in a way, for sort of acknowledging that they're not really that much better off than they were at the start of the last film, because that's what you really want, is that sort of hard reset. And then we have Dana visiting Egon. And talking to Egon about his work, which I find especially comedic. just the way he's taking great joy. Well, not joy. He's taking comfort. I don't know how to say it. Satisfaction. So he has positive feelings towards the experiment that's being conducted, where these people are being left in a room for, it was supposed to be couples counseling, but they've been turning up the heat, and it's very nice. I like it. And then,
he's a scientist. He does what scientists do. He tests all the variables.
Yeah. And then, you know, the kid really likes the puppy, and they measure that, and they're like, okay, now what would happen if we take the puppy away? I love it. But you know, that's the kind of comedy writing that I enjoy. And, he agrees to take this on with Dana, and says that he'll have to bring in Ray. And she says, okay, that's fine. Just don't bring in Venkman. And then this is where it starts to set up. Oh, maybe somebody is not well-liked by everybody else. And that maybe things went a little south for him in the intervening years. And
super believable. Super believable based on both Bill Murray and his character from the first movie.
Yes, very believable. And we then cut to Bill Murray on his little show, his little talk show. And... Oh, it's so silly. They have the thing with the end of the world on New Year's Day. And he's like, well, our next guest will definitely be much better than this guest. And, of course, she thinks she was abducted. And it was at...
by an alien on a Holiday Inn.
Yeah, in Paramus. And she said maybe it just looked like a hotel room, a Holiday Inn Paramus on the ship. But so
it's just delightful to see how much contempt Bill Murray has for the people who are directly in front of him.
Yes. And so he walks his way out of that and then talks to his producer and he's like, I thought we were gonna have credible people. And he's like, it's really hard to book people. The person backed out. They think you're a fraud. And he's like, well, I am a fraud. He's totally comfortable with that. And you know, he's just having a rough time with it all. And he makes up his mind that maybe he'll go talk to Ray and Egon and see how they're doing. So
yeah, he's going to go drown his sorrows in a calzone that Ray's going to buy him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you can drown in a calzone. Maybe it's a, I don't know, maybe in New York they put extra sauce in the calzone.
Well, the sauce should really go on the side.
Well, you should have a little bit on the inside, shouldn't you?
No.
Oh, no. That's you put a little bit on the top if it's, well, it's a certain style. Sometimes you put it on the top while it's baking, and then it sort of like hardens, and then you dip.
No, that's not, no, inappropriate. What you basically want...
Tell that to Southern Italy.
Okay, sure. I don't know. I've never had one there. But I'm sure it would be full of pineapple, because that's just the way the Italians like it, is a calzone full of pineapple.
You know, do not make me text my Italian friend right now to see what he thinks of your pineapple on pizza.
It's a weird podcast threat.
That's all I got. Give it to me.
Okay. Well, you have it. Are we waiting for this to happen now?
No, no. Oh. What time is it in Italy? It's like 6 a.m.
Oh, well, that's the best time to call somebody and ask them. That's trivial pizza topics.
Hey, Marco, what do you think of pineapple and calzones and on pizzas? Mm-hmm. Who is this? Why are you texting me?
Yeah. So the calzone thing, that's fine. So they talk about that, and he comes to find out that they are working on this for Dana Barrett. And, you know, that's good and stuff, because they get to reunite. And it's awkward. Totes awk, as they say. Obvi. Because things did not end well, and he's not really, like, a good person for her. And, you know, that whole chestnut. And they scan things, and Bill Murray makes idle small talk, as Bill Murray does. And, you know, he tries to play cute with the baby, show he's a good guy. They don't find anything in the apartment. Then they go outside, and then Bill Murray's like, I got this. I'll just walk through the street like a New Yorker and make everyone stop. And he does. And then they find some residue, and then they decide, oh, well, that means there must be a whole bunch under here. The only thing left to do is to come back with some really heavy power tools and bust in. And they do. And they go down. Well, specifically Ray. Ray goes down. Everybody else stays up. And then he sees the River of Slime, which is adorable, really, because it's just pink and glowing.
Nice map painting of the subway underneath the road there.
Yeah, yeah. And so they see that, and there's some funny exchanges here with some accents that have been put on.
So bad. There's actually a lot of good dialogue, at least in the first, like, 80% of the movie. It gets a little... I mean, everything gets a little touch and go towards the end of it, but there's a lot of actual good writing in this movie. I was surprised at lines I was actually just genuinely laughing at.
Yeah, well, I really don't take an issue with the dialogue in the film or the jokes. I think it's mainly the plot stuff that it's just like, that's not so great, guys. And that, you know, that only comes up here and there. But for this part, totally fine with it. And the funny back and forth with the Con Ed guys and like, oh, well, the phone lines are over there. And they're like, who do you work for? Or is your supervisor? And he's like, oh, well, there's a gas leak and all that stuff.
Bill Murray gets to be a lot of Bill Murray. He gets to do his riffing thing and be the character that we enjoy. He's also not light on the sort of inappropriate commentary and sexism from the first movie. So he's definitely the same character. He's not just being Bill Murray.
Yeah, well, that's good. But, you know, it's nice, especially when they get into the courtroom scene, and which happens very shortly after this, when they lose power, or, like, the whole city or whatever.
Yeah, where he kicks that empty prop tube that falls on the other empty prop tube, and then some sparks come out, and then the whole city goes
yes.
black.
And then they have them get arrested, and they go to court, and they have their attorney, and of course it's Louis Tully, who, you know, says that it's probably not a good idea to have him as their attorney. He's really good at the comedic effect here, at mentioning that, you know, he just does some probate stuff, and, you know, he got his degree at night school, and they're like, well, that's good because it's happened at night.
And, you know, one time he turned into a dog and they helped. So they're good guys.
And then at the end, when at the end of the whole spiel, when he's talking to Bill Murray and he's just like, and Bill Murray's just like, you know, we helped them enough. And they go and they sit down and the.
Yeah, that's very nice when he's on the stand and Lewis is basically just sort of monologuing and just sort of repeating everything that Bill Murray is saying because he has no idea what he's doing. And Bill Murray's just kind of muttering under his breath. And basically, you know, the whole thing is thrown out because he's leading. And it's just kind of hilarious courtroom antics.
Well, it's kind of funny because she objects because it's leading the witness, but it's really the reverse. It's a clever little thing they did there. But the nice part is when they go to the sentencing and our gruff, no-nonsense judge...
is that how we describe him?
Well, I would describe him that way. Maybe kind of like a jerk, a little bit of a jerk. And so he's you know, all fiery and smacking the gavel and shouting and stuff, and that does not go over well with the slime.
He accuses them of taking advantage of regular people, and if this was years past, he would have them burned at the stake, which is, you know, really something that you want to hear from a judge, an impartial person who has control over your fate.
Yes. Yes.
He sentenced them to, I actually wrote this down, I don't know that I caught it before, $25,000 fine each and 18 months in Rikers.
Yes, I caught that. It's pretty hefty, but it's nice because the whole entire time that's happening, there's that clear container... with the pink goo in it and the pump underneath the table that's making the air bubbles blow into it.
Not at all obvious, by the way.
Yeah, well. And then it explodes, and then some puppets come out. And
which he immediately recognizes. I always thought that was kind of funny. There's just like these 9-foot tall sort of just like Halloween skeletons strapped to chairs, and he immediately knows who they are.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they look like humans at all. So, but he's just like, ah, the, what was it, Scarelli Brothers? Scarelli Brothers. And, he apparently had them electrocuted. So, of course, their ghosts have electric chairs, and there's all this optical lightning all around them, and their eyes are glowing.
They certainly make a hell of an entrance, and then, you know, of course, they quickly dispatch with their chairs because they can't really do any haunting and or attacking when they're attached to their floating electric chairs.
No. And they lift tables and stuff. The table lifting shot's nice. And they, you know, are just sort of like harassing them. It's one of those things. Okay. In terms of this film, this is one of those occasions where it's just like the ghosts in general don't really seem that threatening because we don't ever see them like kill anyone. They just kind of like make noise and like smash things. There's a lot of property
damage. they carry the lady lawyer out of the room.
Yeah, but then they don't do anything. Like, she's fine.
No, she's fine. Yeah, yeah. We see her at the end credits there. The other thing is how convenient that the little scoop of slime that they happen to grab happened to have these two ghosts in it that that know the judge man there.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe he just sentenced a lot of people to death, so that maybe the odds are a little better.
The odds are pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, what if the jar was like somewhere else where like they couldn't actually hear the judge? You know, that they would have all just ended up in prison. So it was just, you know, awful coincidental that it happened to be there and happened to have those guys in it.
I'm sorry, Dan. Are there too many coincidences in your movie about busting ghosts?
In this gritty, realistic scene about judicial restraining orders, I need a little bit more realism out of my... I need a little more motivation from my my puppet ghosts.
Okay.
It's fine. They get to take the proton packs out and talk about how they haven't used them in years and how heavy they are. And it's like, oh, we're so out of practice. I hope they work. And, you know, of course, what is he going to say? They have a half-life of like 1,000 years or something. So
yeah, longer than that, yeah. Yeah, so they take him out. They zap up the place. They use the traps, and get them all squared away. And then they this is after, of course, they get the judge to agree to remove all the garbage that's been dropped on them, so that they can go back to doing their ghost busting, which is important for the film because it's kind of what it's about. And
yeah. So, and this is this the first instance where we see just how windy it gets when there are ghosts around?
I'm trying to remember. In this film, maybe? But I feel like there was wind in the first one. Anyway,
there's a lot of wind. Anytime something creepy is about to happen, a lot of hair starts blowing around, a lot of paper starts blowing around, that sort of thing. And then the ghosts appear, usually. But it gets very windy in the courtroom, like right when the chairs start flying up and down in the air.
Well, I mean, you have to have stuff moving in the frame, I guess, so that way it's a little more forgiving when you have, like, matte lines or whatever. I mean, it just makes the shot feel more alive than if they had, like, a static lock-off that didn't do anything. But they bust those ghosts. They go back. They've got their car. There's the music. Everything's going.
There's their little two-in-the-box rap.
Yeah.
Do, re, Egon.
You know, I got a little bone to pick. Now might be a good time. But this is one of those things, like I was saying with the song, where the movie seems self-aware of the fact that it's in a universe where it is a movie, and that they have all of the logos and patches and stuff changed to the two fingers.
Yeah, that is horrible. I could maybe get away with one if it was like maybe pretending to throw up a peace sign or something. But the fact that their patches all have the two, that's just like, oh, we're going to sell so many of these outfits with the two on them.
Yeah, I mean, nobody will caught dead walking around in one of those ones that's not with the two on it. It's one of those things where it's just like, were you pitching your company as like a second business? Or was this like another branch you were going to open up? You were going to have Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2?
Franchise.
Yeah.
No, they're back, man. They're back. Yeah. And this is Ghostbusters 2.0. I mean, these days they would actually use a 2.0 if they were making this sort of thing. Oh, God, I hope they don't do a 2.0.
No. Well, they wouldn't be. It would be like, what, 3 or 4 or whatever? Does that video game that they made count for anything? I don't know. I never played it. You know the one where they got all the original voice actors back?
No, I have no idea.
No, they got everybody to do it, including Bill Murray, who said that he'd never do another Ghostbusters thing ever again. Because, you know, he's that kind of guy. And they all agreed to do it, and it came out, like, I think for the PlayStation 3 or something like that. It was... I don't think it really was well-received, but it was there, I guess. And so I'm sure somebody will come out and, like, be upset when the other Ghostbusters movies come out and they're like, oh, this is ignoring the canon from the video game. That is to say, I just find it really sort of irritating with the little two fingers. But moving on past that, they're back to busting ghosts. They got their bad commercials. They've got
free thermoses and balloons for the kids.
Yes.
I'm a fan of that. I always like that.
Yeah, and they've got the jogger they bust. They've got
montage number one, if I recall.
Yes, because I mean, that's what you need. You need a ghost busting montage.
There's a couple of them. This is a good one too.
Yeah,
they're back in business. They're doing their thing. Ray is smoking a lot of cigars in this movie, though. I feel like we should be a little concerned about him.
Well, I mean, in general, we should always be concerned about Dan Aykroyd. But they bust all their ghosts, and we also get a scene with Ray and Egon talking about the slime they've been working on. Where they've been doing all these experiments, and they shout at it, and you know Bill Murray is very snide, and he's like, "Oh, this is what you guys do on your free time." And
there's some good Bill Murray in this.
Yeah, he's mostly just a sarcastic jerk, which is fine. But they shout at the slime and say, "Oh, well, it reacts to your emotions. It's like mood slime." And then they do the toaster thing where you can see all the little bits and pieces you probably shouldn't be seeing when the toaster's going crazy.
Oh, I get it. It sings. It sounds just like Jackie.
Yes.
Which always drives me crazy. He says that before the vocals come on in the song, because probably there was no music playing for him.
Yes, and they just said that would happen later. And then it happened later in the cut.
Yeah.
Higher and higher. And so they...
This is version one, and later we get the same song, but an updated 1989 rappier version.
Yeah, well... Also, it's a good thing they got to like test the prototype, because you don't want to just like start out with Lady of Liberty.
You know, you got to work your way up. It starts toaster, and then you go to Statue of Liberty. That's the order of things.
Yeah.
Step one, toaster. Step two, Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, I mean, could you imagine the ridiculousness of just starting with the Statue of Liberty? How preposterous.
How embarrassed would they be if they showed up to the Statue of Liberty and they had like a Sega controller and they're like, oh man, this doesn't work. We should have used the Nintendo one or tested it out or something.
Yeah, but fortunately, they had this toaster to work with and they figured out how to make the perfect spray gun things and manufacture them and then use them later.
They're very polished prototypes. It's very well built by Egon, presumably.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got to make sure all the kinks are worked out before you sell the toys. And so they...
did they actually sell it? I don't think they did, because I know for a fact that I had a proton pack and an outfit when I was a little kid, but I think that was, you know, it's just from the first movie. Did they actually sell the slime guns from the second one?
Yes, but I do not believe they were as popular as the proton packs. There is even a line in here where one of the kids is one of the guys asks for a proton pack for his kid.
That's right. Can I get one for my kid?
Yeah, and Egon's like, they're not toys.
Yeah, this is not a toy. Yeah. Terrible idea.
Yeah, and
All this time, there's so much intercutting going back and forth in this movie. There are so many like quick little vignettes is one of the other things that I sort of took away from this, that the editing is actually, it's kind of all over the place, but it's actually really tight in terms of how they communicate things and when they decide to communicate things, except for that one completely random inserted shot of Cheech Marin later in the movie, which is just totally out of place. But
there's two of them, actually.
I know. There's one where it actually works, and there's another one where they cut back to it. It's like, oh, we could totally reuse this here and pretend that he's looking at something else now. And it's not. It's just another take of the same thing.
Yeah.
But we visited the art gallery twice now. Like, we saw Dana doing her work, and Janosch delivered one of my favorite lines of just as he casually walks past somebody that says, everything you're doing is wrong. Or everything you're doing is bad. Sorry.
Yeah.
he has some good lines in this one.
I really like him. I mean, he's a creepy little slime ball, but I really enjoy him.
He has so many great, like, off-the-cuff lines of just in general. And just, you know, I hope to God it was at least partially ad-libbed, and then they like, oh, that was so great, let's stage that, where he pulls the thing out of our hair. And just like, oh, you had the little white thing here. But because that was just like the best thing he could have possibly been doing when he's being just his weird little creepy self behind her.
Yeah, well, I mean, at first you think he's like combing his fingers through her hair or something like that, and it's just like, oh, it is just a fuzzball. But then you come to find out he's actually pretty creepy.
Like, he's weird and creepy, but he's not that weird and creepy all the time. He's just kind of being himself.
He has some concentrated weird and creepiness. But there's
the other part, like, with in terms of like inconsistencies and like one-off VFX, like there's the first time we see Viggo where he pushes his forehead out of the painting for some reason, because somebody was like, hey, if we did this cool high angle where you could see him both in the frame, we could do a thing where it like stretches his forehead out just this one time, just to, like, see how it goes. And like, yeah, why not? We spent some time and money on that. Let's keep it in the movie, even though it doesn't match anything at all.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of one-off stuff. Viggo has a power every now and then it doesn't really seem to be reused at all. So
he's got lightning that comes out of his painting eyes, and I guess kind of his real eyes too, maybe? I don't know. He's got his yell thing where, like, you know, sonic booms come out of his mouth. Let's see, what else can he do? He can do that cool thing where he strobes when he walks. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That would make for really, like, cool dramatic entrances if you're walking into a party.
But, I mean, what if you're around people who are epileptic? I don't really think that's a good idea, Dan.
No, it's rather inconsiderate, but he is kind of that type of person. In another way that we're paralleling this with the previous movie, Masters of the Universe, should we briefly talk about Viggo and how his voice is not at all his voice?
Oh, he's played by an actor. His voice is not his, and it has like a weird echoey, reverby, like reverby thing like going on. But it's also like not in sync with his lips moving.
And not so much though. He's got a pretty dope name though. His name is Wilhelm von Homburg.
Yeah, I mean,
oh, he died. Damn it.
That's method casting. But the he's. I think the problem with Viggo is that he's not really necessarily as threatening as a god from the first one.
No, he doesn't do much. I mean, and that's not to say that Gozer does a ton in the first one. I mean, she's kind of threatening. But, I mean, I don't know if you want to get into the bigger problem with Viggo in general in this movie is that there's no real threat to the larger public of New York. I mean, he doesn't even get close to threatening them. At least in the first one, we have the Stay Puft Marshmallow man stomping around and ruining things and freaking people out. Like at this, in this one, he's kind of contained to the inside of the art gallery there. And, you know, aside from the ghosts, which are running around and walking around through arches outside that freak people out, everyone else seems pretty chill outside. And, you know, they're having a good time enjoying their new year. And they don't seem really particularly threatened at any point by Viggo.
Well, that's going to come later, after he's reborn. Because...
Right, it's the promise of all of the terror he's going to bring later.
Yeah, well, see, the problem is he wants to rule again. So it's just that it's so far in the future from him maybe not even probably doing the thing that he wants to do right now that it's not super threatening in terms of like a ticking clock or anything like that. That's not like...
No, not at all.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, in this day and age where everyone's blowing up New York every summer, at least twice, I'm kind of fine with New York not really being destroyed. I like the...
No, I mean, just like the threat of it, maybe. Like, the fact that the public didn't even, like, know he existed is kind of a weird thing. I guess... Same thing with Gozer again, but like they saw Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. But like, I mean, there's more to it too. Like when they described Viggo as having died at what, like 105 or 110, and they said he was, you know, poisoned, stabbed, strangled, beheaded, and drawn and quartered and all that stuff. You're like, whoa, this is that's kind of terrifying. But then, you know, at the end they just, you know, they just kind of shoot some lasers out of their proton packs at him, and that's about it. His head zooms away.
And foam goo. That you're forgetting the foam goo.
Well, I can't forget the goo. Sorry. They shoot some lasers and goo at him, and his head sort of zooms away in a nice linear fashion, and then the painting explodes. And it's like, wow. I guess all they needed is like lightning or proton packs back when he was around, and they could have killed him a lot easier. But, you know, modern technology saves the day in this one or something.
Well, yeah, especially when modern technology then repaints your painting.
Yeah, that... I thought that was actually was that the same like frame of painting that we were supposed to get, or was that a different painting? Because I thought it was in a different location in the gallery.
Nope, it was supposed to be the same painting transformed.
Literally the dumbest thing in this movie or any other movie.
Yes. So
like the frame of the painting has some sort of like aura consuming soul that it actually understands what's happening around. It's like, you know what, you bested this bad guy, and I'm going to pay tribute to you by doing this thing.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I don't know. I think they completely could have not had that in there and would have been totally fine. I mean, but they chose to do
it. The joke about the fettuccines wasn't even that funny. I mean, it's a little funny, but that doesn't justify keeping it in the movie.
No. No, does not. Does not at all.
Maybe they just needed one extra thing before they did literally the same thing they did in the first movie, where they roll credits over them walking out of the building and everyone's cheering.
Mm-hmm. Well... I'm glad we got to the end of the movie so fast.
I'm sorry. Viggo, I have a lot of problems with Viggo, and it all sort of comes to a head there towards the end, but it starts right here, where he just sort of stands there, and he smiles. Like, why is he smiling at Dana? Like, this is another instance where, I don't know, has he marked her already? Has he marked Oscar already? Do we know, like, why he's picked Oscar, or is he just, like, going for the nearest baby? Can he smell that she has a baby? Like, Oscar threw up on her sweatshirt, and he's like, oh, I think you have a child at home, so I'm going to smile at you, so hopefully I can steal your baby at some point.
Well, I mean, he might have overheard her saying to Janosch that she's going to be leaving soon because she wants to go back and to the orchestra now that her baby Oscar is a little older. So maybe he overheard that, but at the same time, if it didn't really matter what kind of kid you have... I can think of lots of other ways to get a kid that are way less complicated than stalking her.
Yeah, you know, he can go knock up some hellhound or whatever they say.
Yeah,
later.
Some willing hellhound. That's an important distinction.
Of course.
But the it's so weird. The whole thing with that conversation that she has with Janosch and like the painting forebodingness that we're supposed to get from it bending and flexing when it shouldn't be. You know, that all exists, but, you know, Viggo is just kind of blah, like, overall, and I just don't care about him. I mean, I like his olive oil, I like his crushed tomatoes, but I just don't care for him.
He's a menacing look. He's got the lightning eyes, he can control Janosch, apparently, to make him do stuff.
But if you can control Janosch, why didn't he just control everyone? Like, he doesn't...
Yeah, he could have just had, you know... Dana, bring the baby.
Yes.
And then there's the thing where he kind of turns into the demon monkey thing, which I always find very funny when he says, you have been a naughty monkey, because he's got those things on his head, which I don't know if those are ears or like horns or just weird like sores on top of his head or something.
I always thought those like were supposed to be like horn nubs or something. I don't know.
I thought they were like little teddy bear ears or something.
It's not a threatening thing because they're not pointy. They're just these little like pink slimy circles that protrude a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean he's frightening when he's that. I'm not certain what that has to do with him being a magician, which is what Janosch calls him, a very powerful magician from years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe part of his magic comes from a demon or something like that, but they don't really elaborate on any of these things.
No. And he doesn't really jump into demon mode very often.
No, well, but it doesn't even make any sense when he does, because it's like, if he has all this power where he can, like, get out of the painting and walk around, or he can, you know, just zap people and sort of control them to do his bidding, or if he can just sort of become one with them just by looking at them for a little bit, then it's just like, well, you could have done all of these things. Like, why the end of the film?
Yeah, I think part of the intention for the coming out of the painting and some of the power and all of this has to do with the New Year's timeline being related to when he can do the face meld with the baby. Like, they didn't explicitly call that out, aside from the fact that the guy on World of Psychics in the beginning was actually kind of right. They didn't really explicitly say this time period is the only time when the moon is in line with a star or something, or whatever reason they felt like coming up with to say that, well, this is when Viggo can step out of the painting and face meld with Oscar.
Yeah, obviously it's the eye of the universe that's opening behind him. And
sure.
So
the eye of the subway tunnel full of slime.
It doesn't make a ton of sense. I mean, a couple times they keep referencing the fact that the slime is building up and that's what's giving him the power, but...
This is how you can tell these guys would never survive out in the wild, as sort of like wilderness folks. They find the river of slime, and then they follow it to its destination rather than trying to figure out where it's coming from.
Yeah.
I would be more concerned about where it's actually coming from.
Well, I mean, maybe it's like a reverse river where there's like tiny rivulets of it condensing.
Maybe it's like a Mobius river where it only ever moves in one direction towards the... towards the art gallery. And then if you trace it far enough back, it's kind of Escher-y in that it's like coming from the gallery too.
Mm.
The slime is coming from inside the gallery and going to the gallery.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just theorizing.
Okay.
Since they never bothered to trace it, we have no idea.
Uh-huh.
This is very...
Would that have helped?
Very bad science, scientific method.
Okay. You all right with that? There.
No, I'm not at all. We've gone down this rabbit hole where we're officially pointing out all of the logic flaws in this, so I just can't help myself.
Okay, well, I mean, let's go back to the fun part, because there's fun stuff to be had still with the dialogue and stuff. We get all the, you know, quasi-romantic stuff with Peter and Dana, especially when the tub tries to eat Oscar. How she didn't hear that water turn off, I don't know.
I always thought the thing looked like a big tongue, too. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, well, it looks like a big tongue when it does that, but when it's in the water, when it's first, like, plopping in there...
Looks like intestines or something.
Yeah, it's... I have another problem. I know we said we were going to be positive, but I have another problem with the consistency of the slime in this film. It is basically different every time you see slime. There's this... like semi-translucent stuff that you see in the first shot. There's the river of slime, which has this sort of like lava-like consistency to it.
There's a variety of colors in the river of slime. They do that nice close-up where whatever different separated liquids they mix together kind of made kind of cool patterns instead of just blending together.
Yeah, but that's not how it looks when it goes out. And then so like in the bathtub, there's also the stuff that looks kind of like, I don't know, pink shampoo. There's just like a different consistency to the liquid stuff every single time. So I wish they had maybe workshopped a little on how they were going to come up with a material that would look the same in all of these different settings they needed for the script. Because I assume they're making these material changes because they need it to work under certain conditions, like putting it in the water, or maybe this one looks nice when you have it bubble up from the surface, or maybe this one looks nice when you have all these people with tracked on with a matte painting as they bob down it. So they have all these shenanigans. She goes over to his place. Ray and Egon go over to take a look at what's happened and, you know, go through all of her stuff, try on some of her clothes, go through her personal things, that sort of stuff. And, you know, they decide that Dana should stay with Peter, and this is awkward because, you know, at the beginning of our film, Dana's very unhappy with staying with Peter. And Peter is very ambivalent about Dana at first, only that he doesn't really, like, have dates with her and wants to have them, but doesn't seem, like, on a level where he's ready to commit to anything with her, which was, according to the dialogue, her initial problem with him. And there is some little romantic banter back and forth between them, especially over, like, cleaning and, like, where clothes go and the different stages of dirtiness. Like, there's not just clean and dirty.
Sure. Yeah. You just hang the shirt outside the window for 20 minutes, it's good as new. Mm-hmm. Which, it'd probably actually be much dirtier if you hung it outside the window in New York, but that's beside the point, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's New York. There's, like, a basic level of dirt. Maybe it's just returning it to basic dirt level. But they have their romanticness stuff going on, and of course he meets Janosch at her job. And mm-hmm.
I know Bassmasters. That's one of the best delivered lines in this movie.
I love that. One of my two favorite programs.
Oh, what was the other one?
Bassmasters. It's a fishing show.
It's just like the disappointment in his voice as he's walking away.
Yeah. Well, you know what would be nice? We should have a fishing podcast where you just listen to the sounds of people fishing for like an hour and a half. Just like, you know, casting lands in the water.
Just be like reel it back the in. Sound of running water and like the occasional blooping sound.
Well, and then like, oh, we got it. Oh, it got off. And then, you know, that would be the tension in it that would keep people coming back, whether or not we caught any fish.
Sure. We could discuss various bait accoutrements and the various methodologies for casting for the appropriate distance associated with whatever sort of river you're fishing in.
Oh, I forgot about casting. Yeah, then you got to deal with the agents.
Right. They always get a 10% cut, and then you got to throw it 10% further just to land where you thought you were going to land.
Uh-huh. So...
like sales tax. You always got to factor that in before you get into it.
And now we've scared away everyone. he goes in and meets Janosch. Janosch is nonplussed about meeting Peter Venkman because, you know, he's moving in on his girl, as he sees it, apparently. Which doesn't make any sense.
I love when he threatens to paint a kitten on Vigo. Janosch just loses it.
It's so nice. I love it. But they have their little... you know, his Carpathian kitten loss. And they have their little thing, and he leaves and stuff, and the painting is not happy about it, and Janosch is just trying to console the painting, which, again, seems weird to Peter. And
they just both look over and see him sort of gesturing and talking to it, and he's just, you know, you can't tell if he's just your regular old New York crazy person or if there's actually something going on here.
Yeah, and Dana mentions to Peter, I get the feeling that it's watching me, even smiling at me, winking at me.
Be a little more on the nose. Thank you for that.
Yeah, this painting is suspicious.
There is a lot of... I don't know. I feel like a lot of it had to do with either coverage or the way that they shot it without really knowing that they were going to do a lot of the inner cutting and interspersing. But there is a lot of that sort of stuff. And it's not just exposition. It's exposition that we already know as the audience. And it's actually super annoying to rehash.
Yeah. Because, I mean, we kind of need to know why the characters pass this information along to one another. But it's not, like, entertaining for us when they do it.
I don't think we needed that, because we get the that fun moment in the dark room later where they sort of go over the history of Vigo and, you know, in a little bit more depth on their 9-inch black and white Hewlett-Packard computer or whatever the hell that was, just reading about all of the horrible things he did and all of his various nicknames. And I think we got enough of a background about him there if we didn't already get the, you know, He's 105 years old and stuff. Well, I guess that's later.
Yeah, well, that's later. But, I mean, we do need to know this. Otherwise, we wouldn't know why Peter would look up any of that stuff later, because Peter wouldn't know. So that's why they have it in there, to communicate to Peter. It's just that it does nothing for us as the audience.
I don't know. I guess I would have liked something more along the lines of he was savvy enough to realize that something was weird with Janosch and this painting, and just, I don't know. They could have done something other than Dana saying, I think the painting is looking at me, because that's just a weird thing. Because is he just assuming that, like, well, she's got this one weird thing going on in her life where the baby carriage ran away. Potentially there's another weird thing going on in her life with this painting, so let's just keep poking and prodding until we find something.
I don't know, Dan. I don't object that much to it, especially since we've spent longer talking about it than it was in the film.
Yeah. Maybe if she had been working on cleaning or restoring Vigo a little bit, there would have been a closer tie that made a little bit more sense. I don't know.
No. It's fine. It's not that big of a deal.
I find the leap dubious and the dialogue unpleasant.
Okay, I just want to move on. Fine, it's terrible. It's the worst thing in the world.
It's not.
Okay, well, it's not. Anyway, let's get past this. It was like 2 seconds. So they have the whole thing where they want to go back and check out the River of Slime some more, and that involves going underneath the city again, and... You know,
because they see with the whatchahoozit machine in the picture of Vigo, you could see the slime.
Yeah, and I skipped over the whole scene where they go and they do the model shoot, and Venkman's shouting, you know, at him to work for the camera, and that, you know, he's worked with better, but not many. So that's nice. And then they go back to the development, and they do the development, and then catches on fire, and Winston saves all their lives in one of his few scenes in the film where he does something.
I like that they get locked in there from the outside, and rather than unlocking it and coming in, he kicks the door in from the other side.
I always feel bad for Winston. Poor guy. But they, because they just don't give him much to do, because it's mainly like a Dan Aykroyd and a Harold Ramis, you know, back and forth, and then a Venkman thing with Data, and then he shows up and talks to them on occasion, and then Winston just gets to show up every now and then and just, like, break a door or get run over by a ghost train or something like that. Like, he just doesn't get much going on there.
Well, he's always supposed to have been the straight man who's just kind of on the outside of these weirdos.
Yeah, but even Janine and Lewis Tully, they have more development in this. Slimer has more development in this than poor Winston does.
I don't know. I mean, when they are down in the tunnel looking around before the ghost train, he's the one that doesn't get an echo, and then a large...
Winston!
Yeah, that happens, yes. Yeah.
Well, I always thought that was just sort of weird. Okay, for some reason, there is some force trying to scare them away. But it's doing a really shitty job scaring them away, because there's... a whole sequence of events that happen first with the echo, like you're saying, and then with the really fake mannequin heads on sticks
surrounding them.
Yeah, and then after that all dissolves, then it's the train track noises, and how scary is that? And you know what? That would theoretically be scary by itself, but we've had so far the echo thing and the really fake looking head, so we're not really... I'm not in like a mental space where I'm like, oh no, these poor characters. I'm just like, this is obviously going to be another, like, completely harmless thing, too. And it is.
Yeah, who cares about the train sounds coming? Because we were just surrounded by decapitated heads on sticks.
It's a weird escalation of events, especially since the train does nothing to them. It just runs through Winston, and he just gets scared a little bit. And then, for some reason, Egon speculates as to exactly which train derailment caused that ghost train to appear.
Oh, of course, because it's got to be a ghost train that actually, you know, had a ghost, like a train death.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, you gotta shoot a train with a silver bullet when it dies. Otherwise, you get a ghost train. But the it's weird. They have that thing, and I always find it kind of funny because the train is not really interacting with him. It's just sort of composited onto him, and like you can see it wobbling around, and it's just like, this is not really like, I'm not gonna say A plus for that. But then they're like, okay, we must be really
close.
Some
light and some wind, and his hat falls off.
Yes. Well, you need wind. It gets kicked up from all of the train ectoplasm. But then there's the speculation, like, oh, we must be getting really close because it's trying to scare us away. And it's just like, that doesn't make any sense.
Is that how it works?
Like, again, like, these ghosts, I mean, in terms of, like, scaring people away, like, the ghosts in Beetlejuice are more effective than these. This is, like, not doing anything. They find the River of Slime, and they're like, wow, this is crazy. Let's throw this line into it. And I'm going to make sure that it is attached to me, because that's also amazing and sound and a good thing to do. And then they all go for a little dip. And there's some dubious effects work that happens for them going down this river. I know that in the time they were limited in ways that they could composite things, but I would have just not composited this because it looks like not great. Like they just kind of like float and translate around. It's not good. But they go down the river and they come out by the museum, and how suspicious is that? And they're all angry and they're to beat each other up. But oh no, Egon's the voice of reason. He says, we're just angry because of the slime. Take off all your clothes. And that'll also be good. And so they do that. And then they're standing around in their pajamas and they're like, oh, I was just about to kill you. I'm so sorry. I don't know what came over me. It must be the slime, the mood slime. And
meanwhile, it's all over their face, and it just took a little tiny bit in the toaster to get that working. But that's cool.
I bet they
swallowed
some.
As long as they took
too.
Off their jacket, basically, they're fine.
Yeah, I bet they swallowed some and it's up their nose. But they got, I mean, you saw what it did to the tub. So we go back to the restaurant where Venkman and Dana had a very nice dinner up until this point, and they ruin everything. And Venkman has some interesting lines that he delivers to them on the sight of them, and then they are arrested and taken before the mayor. And as you do, really.
I love that they accidentally throw some slime on a innocent bystander.
Yes. Yeah. So, but they meet the mayor, and they meet our evil government guy for this film, who generally plays jerks for the most part in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. So he goes on and he does that here. He is a very good jerk. And they get their moment to explain their situation, and then afterwards, Venkman's like, we're going to go to the press, and he's like, okay, well, you just need to explain this to my guys downtown, and then he has them committed. Surprise.
Yeah, and you know, you think they would have been able to talk their way out of it quicker, considering that the shrink there was Bill Murray's brother.
I did not know that.
It's Brian Doyle Murray! How do you not know who Brian Doyle Murray is?
I didn't even know he had a brother.
He has like five brothers.
Okay, well, good for him.
Anyway, Brian Doyle Murray, he's in Caddyshack also.
I don't remember him.
Oh, you make me sad. Brian Doyle Murray's great. He's in Groundhog Day, too. He's the guy who chokes on the steak. Was that also a mayor?
Yeah, it's not ringing any bells. I don't think it was the mayor.
He was the guy who was in charge of the ceremony or whatever.
Okay, I don't know. Anyway, do you want to just keep saying brother. Things so I can say I don't know who it is?
Sure. It's his brother. They're in things together. They're both actors. They're good.
Okay.
He had a mustache in this one.
Oh. Well, that's probably why I didn't recognize him.
Mustache and a lab coat.
Yes. And so they have their little conversation with him. This is when we get our exactly the same thing as the first film, where all the ghosts come out and all the bad stuff starts happening.
The mayor gets to say, get me the Ghostbusters.
Yes, because I had a conversation last night with Theodore LaGuardia, and he's been dead for, what did he say, like 50, 60 years?
Something like that.
Yeah. And like the Titanic comes in to dock, and that's not at all how the Titanic sunk in that manner, but, you know, good for Jack.
There was a hole in the side of the Titanic.
All right.
I mean, it was a little large.
It was not a little tiny circular hole that people could walk through, but it cracked the whole thing. Go watch the documentary.
You mean the part after the hole where it broke in half? Yeah,
I mean the part
that.
Where it's on the bottom of the ocean. But
it's a ghost Titanic.
Yeah,
you know,
just like the ghost train.
There's no saying at what point you turn from real object to ghost object. I assume maybe it's immediately as soon as you died. And I think the Titanic probably died when all of the water got in and shorted it out, which was before it broke in half. So that's my justification for that completely ridiculous thing.
Oh, so it had an out-of-boat experience when it watched itself sink?
Yes, it had an out-of-boat. anyway, it's apparently very surprising that all of these old dead people are showing up. Cheech Marin is completely incapable of closing his mouth.
Yes, well, I don't know why they went with that cameo, but he's there, and he does that.
Open your eyes wider. Open your mouth wider. Look more shocked. Look more shocked. Okay, good. I'll do that again.
Faster, more intense. But so they go through this. Oh, but I really like the mink coat as she walks through a whole pink layer of goo, and the mink coat comes to life, and the little puppets move around. Jumps off.
So it's pretty good. It's definitely one of those memorable ones. Although there is a little bit of a does the coat actually drag on the ground? I think it just kind of like crawls up her shoes or whatever. There is a little bit of a leap from the goo from her shoes to the jacket, which I guess is fine.
Well, it doesn't actually touch the jacket.
I know, that's what I'm saying, but the jacket comes to life. Maybe like it was on the heel and kind of like flicked off the back as she kept walking.
Yeah, or it's just about being in the general presence of it. I have no idea.
Transitive property of slime, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was by osmosis through her or something. I have no idea. She acts as a psychothermic conductor or whatever he says. Psychomagnetheric?
There you go. That's what it is. A psychomagnetheric conductor of slime.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, psychomagnetheria is really, you know...
Is that what came after Beatlemania?
Yeah. No. So they do this, and they have the montage, and the mayor is very angry and fires the government guy. Does this seem reminiscent of anything? And gets back the other
peering out the window, and then you've got the cloud tank in the sky, and everyone's going, oh, I've never seen anything like that before. Have you ever seen anything like that before? I've never seen anything like that before.
5 years ago.
And of course the answer is yes, for the love of God. We all saw the same thing when they did it last time, except it was over a building instead of over sort of Central Park.
Yeah, and the shell of goo surrounding the museum where Dana works. And
yeah, looks like Jell-O.
Yes. It's a nice little exchange, you know? There's always room for Jell-O. But they have their little thing where they're just like, well, we're not going to be able to get in. They try the proton packs and stuff, and they're just like, this isn't working. We need to...
We completely skipped over the baby abduction.
Oh, okay.
So much intercutting in this thing. So you basically, while they're kidnapped or whatever, or they're talking to the mayor, you know, Dana's hanging out with Lewis and Janine, and the baby's presumably sleeping while they watch their movie, but he ends up climbing out the window and standing on the ledge, and then the ghost of Janosch, who is not dead, flies in with a carriage dressed like a woman and takes the baby away with a big stretchy sort of Fantastic Four arm with claws on it.
See, that always raised a bunch of questions for me.
Which part?
All of it. Because how did the baby go out there? Was it lured out there? If it was lured out there, why wasn't the ghost already there? If it's a ghost, why is it Janosch? Because Janosch isn't dead. But if it's just like a random ghost that, you know, they were just like, we're going to make you look like Janosch just to really freak Dana out. Like, it doesn't make any sense either.
Well, there was also the part earlier in the movie when the power was out where he was like shooting flashlights out of his eyeballs because the power was out.
Yeah, well, I mean, that goes back to Viggo's inconsistent powers. But the...
Is it lightning or is it incandescent light bulbs in your eyes? Pick one.
But also, like, so they do this, and it's just sort of random, because then it's like, well, why did you need to abduct the baby in this way? Like, if you were a ghost person, couldn't you go inside of the house? I mean, you're not a vampire. You can just go inside and get the baby. Like, why would it have to be on the ledge?
Is it ghosts or is it another type of animal or a creature that you have to invite them into your home before they're welcome? So they can't cross over the threshold unless they're invited.
No, those are just vampires.
That's just vampires?
Just okay. Vampires.
Well, then the ghost just could have like flown in the open window and then grabbed the baby.
Yeah. No need to have him walk on the ledge. But the
or be awkwardly propped up to appear standing on the ledge.
Yeah. And it's also weird because why have the ghost of Janos, who isn't dead, do it? As opposed to like another ghost or something?
Well, that's so Dana can go, no, it was Janos. We have to go to the gallery and get my baby back.
But see, that doesn't make any sense, because why does she need to go there? I know that there's the conversation that's really weird that happened before this, where Janos is talking to Viggo, and he's just like, you know, I would really like to have her as my wife. That would be great, you know, and just like, can I please? And then, of course, Viggo, you know, just doesn't know how to treat women, so he's just like, yes, she will be wife to you and mother to me. And it's just like, this is also really weird. I don't know what you're thinking, Viggo. But that was
he should have started calling Janos Papa after that.
So weird. Oh man, that would have been very strange for the rest of the film. Dad, go save Dana, save mom, capture mom. That'd have been weird.
Now Viggo, no ruling New York until you have cleaned your room.
Yes. Yes, we'll rule mostly Viggo, but
it's a very awkward family unit.
It is. Well, I mean, it would have been. It didn't happen, thank God. But they go through the whole rigmarole surrounding this, where he explains his awkward parental situation, and they make their agreements about how to divide up a woman and her child for themselves, which is weird. And then Ghost Janos does this thing, and then Dana is tipped off and goes to the gallery. Again, doesn't make any sense. I mean, if he's like some ghost with superpowers, can he just abduct her there too? Like, why does he need to like lure her with his fake presence to the... Anyway, we're spending too much time on this, but it's dumb. It is not good. It is not well thought out. I think they wanted the shocking visual of it, but it does not stand up to any sort of like logical progression of events in this film. So she goes to the gallery by herself. Not smart. The guys.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure why Janine and Lewis just sort of decided to hang out and not go.
I don't know. Maybe they had Peter's keys and needed to let him back in when he came back. It doesn't make any sense. But you know, Lewis is, you know, decides later on that he's going to go slap on the proton pack and stuff, but that's not till much after this.
I suppose that's probably why he has to stick together with Annie Potts so she can sort of help him out.
Yeah, but it doesn't make any sense, because, like, why did she go by herself? And she didn't even call, like, the police or anything. But she goes to the gallery, it seals behind her, the goo comes down. The goo traps her in the building, jello stuff. they shoot the thing, doesn't work. She's trapped inside the gate thing, which is weird. He just kind of like uses whatever he's got to trap people, but
he just kind of like puts her in one side of the gallery and closes the door without a lock on it.
Yeah, and you know, Janos has a pretty funny conversation with her where he's not really in tune with his human side anymore, and it's just about like whatever seems like a good idea to someone who is not well. And so he's talking.
Wouldn't it be cool to be the mother of a god? I'm just saying, maybe eventually we could love each other in, like, you know, 50 years or something.
It's weird. It's very weird. And so at some point she begrudgingly agrees to this and wears the little birthday hat, or New Year's hat, and they
that's her signal of compliance, is the New Year's Eve hat.
Well, she's wearing it, so I don't know. I mean, but I never got the of course she's just agreeing to go along so she can save her son Oscar, but anyway, the whole thing's weird. They can't get in, so then they naturally leap to the conclusion that they will go to Liberty Island, and
well, they make the gigantic leap of the fact that they need to find a symbol that will rally the city to generate enough positive energy to overcome this negatively charged slime, which is now a hardened shell around the gallery.
Yes,
which it's like 8 logical leaps in one, but sure. And then, of course, luckily somebody sort of crouches down and looks at the New York license plate and sees the Statue of Liberty, because, you know, New York.
Yes. And so they go to Liberty Island. There's a nice shot looking down from the top of Liberty Island, because that's not really a real shot, but it's nice. And they decide to pilot her by mm-hmm. spraying her with all of this goo. And that detaches her perfectly from the structure that she has always been a part of and doesn't really have, like, the bottom of her feet, because she wasn't constructed that way. But whatever. We'll move right past that. It's fine.
Well, they also speculate as to whether or not she's clothed underneath there.
Yes.
She is French, you know.
Yes. Well, you know, who knows? Maybe with all that ghost slime, she gets miraculous souls to her feet or something. Oh, it's, you know what it is? It's from all the ghosts in the slime. That's how she gets souls for her feet.
I don't even know what
and they're just like souls. They go swimming in the river. Now, so they walk through the river, and it's weird. And also,
the torch bursts into flames too. That's nice.
Yes. Well, I mean, why not?
And gotta light the way.
Yeah, and they well, and not make any ripples in the water. Just perfectly mirror surface. But
they're moving slowly. Is that how water works?
No. And so they, I mean, given the technology they had, they were working on like a wake behind it. But they get to New York, and there are a few shots of a person in a foam rubber Lady Liberty costume.
I love those shots too, especially the one where she like rounds the corner when the buildings are clearly part of the set too, and they sort of composited the people into the foreground, where she's just trying not to move at all. And it seems like some shots they gave her the mask that looks like the Statue of Liberty's face, and then other shots they just literally painted her face green so she could look around and see what she's doing.
I did not get that impression, but I like all the window reflections they did, where they like cut out and put in reflections in the windows to try and pull off that little look. It was just, you know, an extra level of thought and care put into it by Dennis Muren of ILM. They walk through the whole thing slowly, so painfully slowly, to the whole entire time we listen to this music that they're playing and everybody's singing along.
It's a very large statue, and to appropriately communicate the scale of the statue, it must move slowly.
Yes, yes. But then they have their little thing where they finally get there, and they go lean towards the dome, and the slime retreats, and then they break it, and then they come down on their little cables and rappel down into it.
The Statue of Liberty generates so much positivity that it creates like a slime bald spot on top of the glass there, just so they can knock it in and jump through.
Yeah. Well, obviously that's the best way to break in. It's not like through a door or something, but,
so they got the feet. They could have just kicked the front door.
Yeah. But maybe they didn't want to damage the soles of her feet, but, so they break in, and then the Statue of Liberty falls over backwards. Cause we don't see it looking up again. And then also in other shots of outside later on when they're singing and we have to cut away to what they're doing, there's a Statue of Liberty lying on its back. And it's just like, did it lie down and go to sleep, or did it fall over backwards and kill all those people?
Maybe when they left, the Nintendo controller got disconnected or something. And then like it just, you know, turned back into a puppet.
It was weird. But they go in and they confront Janosch and Vigo. And there's a lot of like back and forth and fake outs and stuff. And they try to shoot Vigo, and it doesn't really go over well. First they slime Janosch just to get him out of the way for the whole ending part of the film.
Yeah, victory right there, man. They knock him out with the slime, and he's going to wake up feeling like $1 million because, you know, they positively charge their slime.
Yeah.
Because they are now masters of this technology.
Yeah. Well, they should open up a day spa. You just go put on a little slime mask.
like a mud bath, but positively charged slime.
Yeah. Get that in all your orifices.
Makes you feel... Oh, dear.
Yeah. So Vigo comes out and, like, his little ghost time echo thing going on, and they shoot him with proton packs, and that doesn't do anything. He knocks them all to the ground in a somewhat you can't move but kind of if you scoot a little kind of a way.
He immobilizes them with something.
Yes,
his power.
Mm-hmm.
He's so strong, he knocks them down and immobilizes them.
Yes,
which makes you wonder, why didn't he just like sort of immobilize them in place if that's what that was his goal?
It doesn't. Well, I don't know why he didn't do that first thing, but
before they hosed Janosch.
Yeah, I don't know. His tactical planning leaves a lot to be desired. Because
no, this whole section here is where it all just goes to hell.
Yeah, none of this really like works logically. It seems like there's just like an escalation of things that is very uneven, where different. As events unfold with like a twist of like, oh, you think you got him, but you don't. Oh, you think you got him, but you don't. And it's just like, but none of this really makes sense because you didn't do this any of this stuff before. So then all of a sudden you're just doing it now. You know, and like we said earlier, like the demon head appears. And it's like, why did that happen now? Like towards the end. Why are we looking at the edge of his contact lenses in that close-up shot? But
well, he immobilizes them. And then he moves the big boxes out of the way to reveal Oscar back there, which, you know, they kind of timed it to match his hands, but not so much. And it always bothers me when I see that. It's like the thing you do when you walk up to like the automatic glass doors at the grocery store and you like try and swipe them as if you had the force, and you always miss the first like three tries.
I don't know what you're talking about, Dan. I am a Jedi master when it comes to grocery door
store doors. You always get the grocery doors first try?
Yeah.
Well,
not the ones you have to step on. Those are a little trickier because there's a little bit more of a delay with those ones.
Do they still make those?
No, not really anymore. But I think the last time I saw one was like 3 years ago or something. The further you go from a civilized town, the more likely you are to run into one of those.
I'm going to say, I haven't seen those in 5 or 10 years or something.
Yeah, it's uncommon. But the events unfold here where he moves everything aside, gets the baby, and he will join with the baby and stuff. But fortunately,
now we will become one or something.
Yeah, he should really just hurry it up. Also, I don't know why he can possess like Rey in like 2 seconds, but this baby is like taking forever.
well, he pre-installed his software on Rey.
What?
Remember when Ray was staring directly into the painting and he kind of like went limp or whatever and he was locking eyes with him?
Winston sort of snaps
him out of it?
Yeah, yeah. But again, that was also like 2 seconds. So he's looked at this baby for far more than that in the whole duration of this end part of the movie. But fortunately, he starts making lion noises because outside people are singing. And
sure, it's coming in through the opening in the roof.
Yeah, I mean, well, because that's just how it happens. And they have so much to celebrate because it's New Year, obviously.
The Ghostbusters are inside this building, presumably kicking butt, so we're excited. When they come out, they'll probably be victorious, so we're pretty stoked. There'll be a big party, maybe a ticker tape parade. So, you know, we're just going to enjoy our New Year's. We're going to sing and have a good time and all that.
Yeah, it's definitely not spring or summer. It's totally the winter. And they...
Well, in the shots of Lewis when he's running around because he put on his proton pack, he's you can see his breath. It's cold for him.
Okay.
And he puts on the little earmuffs.
I like the earmuffs.
It's a good look for him.
They entertain me. Especially also when he like does his like military kind of like walk down the street and like double checking and stuff. As he rounds the corner and like makes his way to the bus stop,
right.
I like that. And then he agrees to go on with Slimer, which is a nice reconciliation between the two.
Didn't know you had your license.
Yeah, and they wind up, of course, at the museum, and he's shooting the ray at the thing, and so he thinks he did it when everything happens,
and everyone outside thinks he did it too. They all start applauding him because they have no idea what's going on inside.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But
they should have at least figured out a way to get like jack into a CCTV feed or something so they could sort of watch what's happening inside.
No, but remember how last week we were complaining about how the universe is music, all that nonsense, and how like the tones like made things possible. Singing defeats the bad guy in this film.
singing weakens him to the point where they can get up out of their little ground coma there.
It neutralizes all of his power and makes him go back inside of the painting.
Most of his power, and they catch Oscar, but that's when he turns into the monkey. Like, he's trying to, like, rally and, you know, fight back, and then he ends up back in the painting as just sort of, like, the disembodied head that gets hosed.
Yeah, and...
Well, and then he knows he's losing, and they're getting ready to blast him, and then he calls on Rey. He launches the application on Rey there, and, Ray shouts at them for a minute, and then he gets hosed, and he's done too.
Yeah, it's a good thing they had all that goo. It was some foresight, and so I mean,
Maybe that was written in because they're just like, we got this extra goo. I mean, why don't we shoot a scene where Ray gets possessed and then we'll just get that other little insert earlier where, you know,
well,
he gets the Vigo in him.
No. No, I think that the crushed tomatoes? No, but I think that this is about... I think this is more about like how Ray kind of screwed up everything at the end when they're fighting Gozer in the first movie, and he kind of screws up some stuff a little bit here.
Oh, is this supposed to be the parallel with that?
Yeah. Well, I'm assuming because like he, like it's his fault we get the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man because everyone was supposed to clear their minds and he doesn't. And in this one, he's supposed to move out of the way of the painting so they can shoot the monster, and he doesn't. And he,
there's really no consequence to that.
Yeah. Well, he becomes the monster.
I mean, he becomes like, well, kind of, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So is what Ray becomes sort of like the halfway thing that Vigo was trying to do with Oscar?
I don't know, because it doesn't make any sense. Could you imagine like a really tiny makeup appliance like that on Oscar? That would be weird.
A little tiny monkey-faced baby.
Well, I like all the times where they were adding the photography of the actor who plays Vigo on top of Oscar's face.
And yeah, where the eyes don't line up.
It doesn't light up at all.
I mean, they get close. Like, they get the nose and the mouth, but yeah, the eye. I mean, he's got the biggest head compared to the baby.
But the baby also doesn't look the right way, because it's a baby. I mean, what's...
Oh, yeah. You know, you can't control his eye line all that well.
Yeah, he can't just sit still, like, for VFX. Like, he doesn't care.
Nowadays, we would just, you know, reposition his head in post.
Yeah, we just have a digital baby.
Yeah, but like the thing is, like if he started to transition into Ray in the same way that he was trying to do with Oscar, like why did he need a baby? Did he just want like to start young so he had another 105 years or another longer lifespan?
No, but if he could just jump from person to person, it doesn't really matter. So again, it doesn't make any sense. Like he could have just had Janosch earlier.
Yeah, like once a year on his New Year's Eve birthday, he could just jump into a new body.
Yeah. I mean, think about all the endless creative possibilities. But I don't know. It's one of those things where they didn't really set up any rules for how Vigo's power works or why he does anything. So then you kind of wind up with this wishy-washy, like, just stuff happening but not happening stuff that happens here.
He started out as mysterious and kind of fascinating and a little ominous. And then he just ends as kind of useless and uninteresting.
Yep, I'm not a fan.
And he's got some nice poofy hair. He's got some like teased out hair metal 80s look going on, and he's got his wide shoulders, which apparently that look is out.
Okay, Dad.
That's what Bill Murray says.
Yeah, they get rid of him. They have their terrible painting. We get the end credits where there are little clips of them laughing and dancing and stuff.
Some of it is from earlier in the movie. Some of it was cut out of the movie. Some of it is just random flashbacks to weird things.
Yeah, and then they have a credit card for... sorry, credit card. A title card for Slimer. And then they have like a little, I don't know, rally ceremony award thing or whatever on Liberty Island for the Ghostbusters.
Sure, that's a totally reasonable thing to do.
I don't like this last shot at all. And they have a huge banner with the logo for the movie on it. Again, don't like it. And they pull out in this aerial helicopter shot over Liberty Island and show us the Manhattan skyline. A few problems with this. How did they get the Statue of Liberty back there? How is the torch hole?
Well, they re-gooed her and then made her stand up and walk back out.
And they fixed the torch?
Sure.
They just glued it together with goo?
Yeah, I think... Is it still gold or is it like faux gold these days?
What do you mean?
The fire on the torch.
Oh, I didn't think it was gold. I thought it was like a yellow glass thing.
I thought it was gold, at least initially. They may have replaced it, but no. I thought that was part of the thing. It was gold.
No, I think it's yellow glass because it lights up.
Well, it does now.
Okay, anywho, it's definitely not as shiny as it was in Five Goes West, but, so they,
oh my god.
It's got a patina. But this aerial helicopter shot, I noticed for the first time ever, I never noticed this before, but, maybe that's because I don't usually watch the credits on TV, because it's usually on TV when I see it, but the camera is moving around in the helicopter, and it tips up a little bit, and we see the helicopter blade come into the top of frame a little bit across the top of Lady Liberty. Just a little hair of it, just a little tiny bit. If you look for it, you'll see it. If you don't know what you're looking for, you'll probably miss it.
I think it was kind of requisite that all helicopter shots in the 80s and 90s had to have at least like a couple frames of helicopter blades on the top of them.
Yeah. Well, nowadays, you'd have to like paint that whole thing out. They'd be like, hey, so we had three other helicopters back there with camera crews in them. Paint them all out.
Honestly, there are worse tasks. It's at infinity. There's no parallax. Were there a couple of clouds at least to track off of?
Well, I mean, you have to reconstruct Lady Liberty's arm.
Oh.
It would have been, no, but it would have been
fine. Oh, because the blades went over top of her. Yeah, no, yes. I don't want to do that. No. If it's just over the sky, that's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been fine, but it's just annoying. Those camera operators just pointing their cameras all willy-nilly.
Yeah, these days you would just use a drone. You wouldn't even see the blades.
You just see the shadow of the drone.
Well, you can see the shadow of a helicopter in The Shining.
Yeah.
In the opening there.
Well, I mean, but no, you know what I'm talking about, like on House Hunters or the Bargain Beachfronts or whatever, they do this stuff, and they have the little drone fly over the property, and it's just like, I can see the shadow. I see the shadow going across the grass.
This peculiar shaped shadow that's over top of the house.
What an interesting quadcopter you guys have. I just mean the neighbors have, because naturally, there's no real camera here. This is just the perspective that God gave us for this. No, it's just from the drone. But that's the whole thing that happens with this. And the movie's over. And honestly, I really don't think it's as objectionable as most people think. I think, like we're saying, that it's really the ending where everything just sort of collapses. But the dialogue and stuff that happens early in the film is kind of funny and quippy and sarcastic. And there are many things that are quite interesting to repeat every now and then to reference.
Yeah, yeah. I look at like I think on IMDb this had like a 6.5 out of 10 or something, and people always talk about like, oh, you know, the sequel to a great movie is never very good, and they always highlight Ghostbusters 2 as an example of that. And you know, this, it's one of those ones that you know all the lines to. There's good writing in here. It gets, you know, it kind of goes off the rails at the end there, which is mostly because, I don't know, they kind of painted themselves into a corner with repeating all of the tropes from the first one, and Viggo was just kind of like a not-so-awesome bad guy. But this movie is actually a ton of fun, and I am so glad that we watched it again, because I was kind of like, Ghostbusters 2, like, I don't know, October, whatever. You know, it's Halloween, scary movie, ghosts, and whatever. But then just, like, it's just a fun, enjoyable movie to watch pretty much any time.
Yeah, well, I mean, just listen to this sparkling dialogue here. Ordinary household toaster. We'll just have to take your word for that.
I do, you know, as with most Bill Murray things, I do kind of want to know how much of it was just ad-libbed.
I don't know.
Because I kind of feel a lot of it was.
Well, I have to imagine that quite a bit of it stems from Harold Ramis and Dan Aykroyd's writing.
Well, yeah, of course. But, I mean, there are a couple moments. Like, the look he gives, at least, and the, you know,
well, looks,
this is what you guys do when I'm not here. And, you know, part of that line, I think, was a bit ad-libbed. But I don't know. There are moments that feel very Bill Murray in here.
Okay. Well, you always like to imagine that there is some sort of, like, creative force that flows through your favorite actors and directors. And it's just like, you know, sometimes it's just what they wrote. But
Bill Murray is a confusing human being to me. Because he does not strike me as the kind of person that would take any job seriously, let alone something as silly as a job like acting.
But he does it.
He does, and he does it quite well, and it's fascinating.
Yep. The end.
It's a good movie.